Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, a prominent trade unionist says South Africans should not be paying for Eskom's mistakes. PwC warning South African businesses are starting to feel the sting of US tariffs. Security experts raise the alarm over bogus Russian-linked job offers targeting young African women. And artificial intelligence is reshaping psycho-legal work in South Africa. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of September. Now, for many South Africans, Eskom, I think, has become a byword for failure and corruption. And once again, ordinary South Africans are being left to pick up the tab. The state utility continues to push for higher tariffs while households and businesses struggle under the weight of a fragile economy. But here's the question. Why should citizens carry the burden of mismanagement, tender fraud and outright looting in many cases? That is a challenge that's being posed by the South African Federation of Trade Unions, and its General Secretary, Zweli Zimavavi, says enough is now enough. And he joins me on the program. Zweli, why do you believe that citizens are unfairly paying for Eskom's corruption? What is the thrust of your argument?
In the main, we are very disappointed, very angry that the people that are pointed out in the Zondo Commission as having been partly responsible for the mess we find ourselves in are the same people that we are being asked to call honorable members of parliament. That's what is driving us mad. And the very same people have so much to say, by the way, about the crisis that we're finding ourselves in. Look, Jeremy, for 16, 17 years, we've now had a total of more than 500% increase of tariffs in Eskom. Extraordinary high, totally shifting the burden of the crisis from the creators of the crisis, but to the ordinary people, the shoulders, the backs of workers, the small, medium, macro enterprises, the unemployed, poor, marginalized majority, including big firms. And the impact of that is now beginning to be overwhelming. And as you can see, that there is no one day that goes by without someone somewhere announcing that is going to shut down, is going to cut the jobs, be it big or small firms. 12,000 jobs are gone in the smelters in South Africa. And AMSA, the ArcelorMittal, is going. And everyone else is saying we can't cope. And the driving factor to making companies unsustainable is the rate at which they are being asked to pay for the failures of Eskom. So we're very angry. We're very angry that this is the situation. Now we are being asked to pay close to 9% for next year and 2 years to come, you know. Three times above the rate of inflation. As you know, the municipalities add their own charges there, 10 some up to 14 some, meaning that actually we are being asked to pay another 18, 19% in a row. And this is happening year in, year out. We can't cope with this.
You talk about an overwhelming burden, yet Eskom would turn around and say that it has a debt relief plan which is designed to protect consumers. I suspect that you would reject that argument.
Absolutely. And we're arguing that the whole structure of Eskom has become unsustainable. You can't continue to ask people to pay these extraordinary amounts of money and to fund corruption. For example, we argue that the whole issue of Eskom's 400 billion rand debt is generated by the overruns and massive corruption that we saw at Medupi and Exile, and we are now being asked to pay billions of rands to the World Bank. And that's why, amongst others, we're demanding that this amount of money be declared odious debts, meaning that the World Bank would have been paying and funding deliberately, willfully, corruption in Medupi and Exile. And it know that part of that corruption, it benefited the ruling party through Chancellor House, and which is facing fire in the United States of America, but it is not facing any kind of consequences here at home, where they actually robbed us. The people who suffered from that corruption are not in the United States of America, but they are here in South Africa.
I'm wondering whether you might ironically now find yourself on the side of business leadership South Africa. Its chief executive, Busisiwe Mavuso, writes that Eskom's tariff system shields it from cost discipline and punishes consumers, as you've just outlined to me. She goes on to say the only fix is to fast-track a competitive electricity market. Is she right?
She's right on the first part. She's wrong on the second part. We are already in that competitive market, if we can argue. Eskom is now somehow subsidizing independent power producers to the tune of 20 billion rands a month. That's privatization through the back door. And Eskom was not allowed to roll out renewables for some time. And that space was occupied by these independent power producers. That's bringing in competition. And the price is... that's where we will disagree with Musa. The price of all of that, as shown by the balance sheet of Eskom, is that we are being asked to fund 20 billion rands because Eskom is effectively subsidizing the independent power producers. It produces electricity and sells it more expensive to these guys. And it's not fair. We demand that the contracts, the secret contracts that have been signed by the government with these independent power producers be presented in public, be publicized. We demand transparency, and we demand a full inquiry by Parliament as to why we signed these agreements and why they have remained secret so many years after they were signed.
I'm wondering to what extent, in your opinion, part of the blame must be laid at the regulator, the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, NERSA. It's been forced to adjust the tariff increases following an error in calculation. Do they carry any of the cam?
They do. We call this the regulatory capture. These guys are yes, boss, yes, ma'am, of Eskom. For years, they have not said to Eskom, guys, how do you think what you are asking us to do year in and year out is sustainable? Asking 20, 25, sometimes 30% increases in tariffs. How is that sustainable? They have not said to Eskom, despite, by the way, having public hearings from time to time, they have not said it stops here and we are now drawing the line on the sand. We have to talk about your structure. And you have to talk about your sustainability, your levels of efficiency, and we have to talk about every of your input cost. How much are you buying coal? From who? And at what price competitively? And whether in South Africa, which is the home of the massive underground reserves of coal, must end up with a crisis of Eskom buying so much expensive coal from companies in South Africa, and sometimes paying them in advance in order to guarantee these companies' lifespan. And we and NERSA is not asking those questions, and we are very worried that this is what we call the regulatory capture.
Zwelinzi Mavavi is the General Secretary of the South African Federation of Trade Unions. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move on to this now. And trade wars have a way of reaching right into our pockets, even when the fight seems far away. You'll know the United States has been ratcheting up tariffs, and the ripple effects are starting to hit South African businesses. Exporters are warning of squeezed margins, disrupted supply chains, and tougher conditions in an already fragile global market. Some analysts say this could drag on investment, job creation, and confidence at precisely the wrong time for our economy. So just how exposed are we right now, and what can be done to soften the blow? With me is PwC Southern Africa's chief economist, Lulu Krugel. Lulu, just remind us again very quickly, which South African sectors are most exposed?
Good morning, Jeremy. It is really very much the agricultural sector, in particular citrus exports, which, you know, the US is one of our main markets, automotive, parts of manufacturing. So it's across the board, basically all sectors except for the ones that have been specifically excluded. But those are probably two of the main sectors, is vehicle exports, automotive, and citrus growers being the hardest hit by what is happening.
And Lulu, quantifiably at this point, are you starting to see exporters already seeing reduced orders?
We definitely have engaged with some of our clients in the agricultural sector. They've definitely seen some impact. In the automotive sector, they've been anticipating this, and a lot of them have started to make other plans a while ago already. But it's not that easy. It's not as simple as saying, okay, I'm going to export to another market. Each market has its specific criteria and specific needs that need to be met from a health and safety and other perspective, or specific requirements if you look at automotive, for example. And we have seen in particular, again, in the citrus industry, they are saying that as much as 35,000 jobs might be affected. And overall, the Reserve Bank is estimating around 100,000 jobs that might be affected by this if it goes its full way. And then, of course, AGOA, all but gone. And that probably also being the one factor that's hitting the automotive sector hardest.
So what then is the immediate knock-on effect? How do these global measures start to filter into our local economy? Because I'm assuming there's a real domino effect here. If you look at the citrus or the automotive industry, it's the entire supply chain, right?
Absolutely. I think one of the first things that we are starting to see is the elevated inflation in the US. So it's not only the tariffs that they've introduced on us, but on the rest of the world. And as economists, we've been looking for a while now to see if that's starting to filter through. So we are seeing that elevated inflation from the US, which will impact inflation levels across the board in the whole world. So we have just gone through a period of high inflation, which we've been able to manage down. And on the back of that, we've been able to, or the Reserve Bank has had the bandwidth to actually reduce the interest rates as well. But because of the potential risk to inflation going forward, I do not foresee further cuts in the interest rate. And there is the potential that we might see higher inflationary pressure starting to creep through. Over and above that, you know, all of these industries are linked into other industries, as you have rightfully said. So the entire supply chain, if you think about the citrus and citrus growers, it's not only about the products that they export. It is all the industries that are in their supply chain that they buy products from. If you think about packaging materials, for example, if you think about transport services that are, you know, reliant on the industry, so many other industries that's linked into it. In the automotive industry, of course, the supply chain is even more complicated, with original equipment manufacturers in South Africa, a lot of them small to medium-sized businesses in a lot of these automotive parks or you know, special economic zones that are going to be impacted by what they are able to supply to these companies if their numbers and their demand start to drop.
You mentioned that many organizations in the two sectors that you've named would have started working on alternative plans, but difficult to say how big that cushion is, given that margins are already razor thin.
Yeah, I know. And I think what we've seen is a lot of companies starting to look at alternative export markets. But again, It's not something that you arrange now. And if you look at automotive, for example, versus this, these are the two examples. It's not the only industry, by the way. The industry that's the most dependent on the U.S. export market is in the shipping industry. I was completely blown away. It's tiny, but everybody in that industry basically have the majority of their jobs and their income dependent on what's happening in the U.S. So it's a bit of a mix. Some industries that are really going to be hard hit, that's very dependent on the U.S., and others that's more important for the South African economy, that's maybe slightly less dependent on the U.S. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. But yeah, a lot of them looking at alternative markets. But the point is, so is everybody else. It's not only South Africa that's being impacted by this. Other countries that have seen tariffs implemented and are also looking at other markets. There are some challenges and some worries about potential dumping from Asia, China in particular. I'm not going to beat around the bush by saying that. So it's not an easy thing to do. And we will not walk away from this unscathed and completely unimpacted. We will be impacted negatively.
So what's
and as you said, it's not coming at an ideal time.
What's the worst case scenario then if the tariffs either escalate or continue in their current form?
So I'm thinking that we're talking about between 100 and our estimations it's up to 240,000 jobs that's dependent on the sectors that are, linked to these exports. If you look at the multiplier effect, so our impacts are a little bit worse than the reserve banks, but that's really in a worst case scenario. But the bottom line is, it's not only a question of the businesses that are in business now. It is, as you rightfully said, as well, potential businesses that's looking at investing. Other businesses, for example, we've just moved into a space where we are seeing private sector investment slightly starting to pick up. And now this is again something that negatively impacts sentiments.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Lulu Kruchel, who is PwC Southern Africa's chief economist.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
So artificial intelligence is changing every corner of the world, from the way we shop and bank to how businesses operate. But it's also starting to enter more specialized, sensitive areas, including something called psycho-legal work here in South Africa. Effectively, the way I understand it, it means technology is beginning to influence how courts, psychologists, legal professionals assess behavior, responsibility, and even justice itself. The promise, obviously, is greater speed and objectivity, but the risks, I think, are stark. Bias, privacy breaches, also ethical minefields. So what does this mean for the broader profession, for society? I'm joined by Dr. Chris Blair, Group Director at the Remunerations Consultancy 21st Century. So maybe let's just wrap a definition around psycho-legal practice in South Africa. Chris, how is AI entering the space and what are the consequences?
Yes, perfect. So psycho-legal practice is basically work injuries that an employee would sustain at work, or the ones that people would know most about is where you have an accident and you claim against the Road Accident Fund. And you claim against the Road Accident Fund, not necessarily just for the medical expenses that you incurred, but for your loss of earnings. So it really revolves around loss of earnings for an employee that sustains an injury through whatever happens to them. That practice is very niche in that industrial psychologists tend to do the analysis of the job that the person is currently in. So if I just use a very quick example, the person is a fit and turner and they lose their left hand, they clearly cannot continue doing the same job. And then the industrial psychologists in that niche area of HR would evaluate what that person is earning currently, and if they had followed the trajectory of that career, what would the loss have been over the period of their career? So what's happened now is that AI has entered into that space, meaning that these industrial psychologists are very intelligent, knowledgeable people, and they using AI to speed up their processes, as you say, and hopefully get more objectivity. But what comes with it is the risks. And one of the obvious risks is where the words I use on AI, and I do a lot of work on AI, is that you're in charge of AI, AI is not in charge of you. So very simply, if you misuse AI, you can just say to it, this person's a fit interner, go and look at the market, tell me what the trajectory would have been and what they should have earned. Now, when AI comes back with the answer, you still have to be in charge and the specialist to look at that information and say, is this sound? Do I agree with it from my knowledge basis, from my qualification basis? And also, is it unbiased? Very important. And then maybe the last risk is how I've got that information, does it impact in terms of POPIA, where I've released information out there on an individual without their consent? So there's a lot of factors to look at with AI, even in a niche space like this, or maybe particularly in a niche space, to protect the employee, to make sure that you do get the right answer and you don't end up garbage in, garbage out.
Let's talk about employee protection in just a moment, but is your concern principally ethical or more procedural?
I think both, Jeremy. So procedural will be very much, you know, have you got guiding principles in terms of your procedure? And that would usually be run by, you'd have an internal AI policy in the company or the consultancy that's using the industrial psychologist to say, these are the procedural standard operating practice that you need to follow. The ethical is actually quite worrying in that, as you know, information can be biased. So a good example in this is that if you plug in and you use AI and you say, what is the loss of earnings for this particular employee who had this injury, and you don't tell AI what the detail around that employee, in other words, we call it the dehumanization of the process, which becomes unethical. So you don't actually take that employee, that industry, those factors into account, you'll get back an answer from AI. AI will always go and find you an answer, but it may not be ethically correct. And you may be jeopardizing the employee or, for instance, the road accident fund in terms of a payout that's not commensurate with what the payout should be.
So what protection or recourse does the employee have if they find themselves at the other end of a machine decision?
So obviously they would be represented by lawyers who would then subcontract the industrial psychologist through a company like 21st Century, and they would have to say to their lawyers, I feel that I'm getting the raw end of the stick here, and their lawyers are representing the employee. So those lawyers should then take on the industrial psychologist or the company that provided the advice to say, for these reasons, we don't believe this is fair, or we believe there's bias in it. Can you explain to us why, if you believe in it, what are we missing here, and what is the employee missing?
Are you worried that regulations are not keeping up with these technological changes that you're outlining, if in fact they exist at all?
Very good question. Very worried. As all the sort of main AI kind of gurus around the world are, from Google, OpenAI, Elon Musk, Grok. And the reality is that the governments aren't keeping up because AI is moving so fast. And the problem is that I call them guardrails. The guardrails need to be in place. So companies that are progressive would have an AI policy with those guardrails in place. But in South Africa, we don't have that from a country legislative point of view. The only country that's really put in anything meaningful yet is Europe. They're a bit more conservative and more concerned about letting AI loose out there. But that's really it. And then, you know, there's a lot of concern in the States because of shareholders chasing profit. And AI is increasing profits at a multiple exponential rate. So the profit seekers are outperforming the governance side of AI.
And Chris, just a final question and a short one, if you don't mind. We've raised all the negatives here, but there must be positives in as much as machines assessing psychological evidence fairly. There would be advantages, surely.
Absolutely. Jeremy, one of the things, if you use it effectively, if you use the AI effectively through a decent policy, obviously there's the efficiency. It does stuff at a fraction of the time that humans do it. But the scalability is the one, because these data sets for medical legal issues are, the data sets are massive. And to get, obviously, the more data you have, the better the answer at the end. And AI is able to go through and use that huge amounts of data to get to a better answer than an individual human, even if they qualified and they're an industrial psychologist. They just can't go through it at the same rate and get that scalability. And so that would be a huge one. Mm. Accuracy, obviously, when people use data, they transpose it, they get it the wrong way around, and then that develops inaccuracy. AI won't get that wrong. And then, funny enough, there's bias reduction if AI is used properly, because all humans inherently are biased. Whether they believe it or not, they are actually biased.
And that's where we are going to leave it. My thanks to Dr. Chris Blair, who is Group Director at the Remuneration Consultancy 21st Century.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, it sounds like an opportunity, a chance perhaps for a better life, a good job, maybe even a career abroad. But in reality, it's a trap. Take a listen to this. Security experts are warning that young African women are being targeted with bogus job offers linked to Russian networks, only to be lured into dangerous and exploitative situations. It's all part of a wider web of trafficking and recruitment that preys on desperation and hope. And South Africa is not immune. And the stories are deeply disturbing. To help us understand the scale of the threat and what is at stake, I'm in conversation now with Martin Iwi from the Institute for Security Studies. Martin, a very warm welcome to you. How widespread is this?
Thank you. Good afternoon to your viewers from Pretoria. Indeed, human trafficking is the biggest transnational organized crime in the world today. So you can imagine. So we are talking of hundreds of thousands of young people who have been trafficked and are working or living in total slavery. So this form of enslavement is something that has been condemned worldwide, but the practices continue.
What methods are being used then to lure women into this situation?
Yes, there are so many methods, but the traditional one that we've seen for over the past 50 to 60 years today is where women from desperate poor or poverty-stricken regions are being lured to job opportunity elsewhere. So they are being told that they will be recruited into jobs that will be will improve their living conditions. So they will get salaries, they'll be able to send back home, and so on and so forth. So it's a very typical human trafficking tactic where you lure your victims by promising them jobs. And at the end, they are caught in a very tight, enslaved environment.
Why is Russia implicated in these operations?
Look, I don't want to say with any certainty that Russia is implicated. I've read the stories of allegations of South Africans being recruited by Russian companies to work in Alubuga factories, but who end up in human trafficking schemes. We don't know yet. I think the investigations are still ongoing. But what I can say for sure is that South Africans are becoming increasingly victims of human trafficking. As we speak, there are South Africans in the Myanmar-Thai border who are trapped because of human trafficking schemes. Right, we have 32 so far that we are dealing with, but there could be more. But investigation is ongoing to really give us a clear picture of what the situation is about. Now, the Russian scenario that we hear today, I'm not saying it's not uncommon. As I said before, that this is a very common tactic that is being used. But what we must What we must do is to ascertain that indeed these young women are being recruited, and when they are in Russia, they find themselves in this enslaved environment, because this is an environment in which their liberty has been completely cut off. The even food and everything they get is in very tiny proportion. So the conditions are appalling, you know, deplorable for any human living standard. But if we don't have the facts, the figures to go with, then it is very difficult. And at the Institute for Security Study, we are monitoring, we are trying to study this to see to what extent this is possible. What we know about the Russia-Ukrainian war is that there is this global recruitment ongoing. You know, we know of a number of countries that have been implicated or have sent troops to Russia to fight in that war. But South Africans who are lured, you know, for job promises, are they being used in that war? Are they being subjected to human trafficking? These are questions that we cannot answer at this moment. But there is a lot going on the internet about these kind of schemes. But none of them has shown, you know, irrefutable proof for us to go with.
I'm wondering how difficult this practice is to investigate, given that a lot of the recruitment would happen on anonymous online platforms.
You see, when a person voluntarily, you know, adhere to a recruitment scheme, say, I want to join this recruitment or I want to be part of it, it is very difficult. But what is not difficult to find is that if indeed these places do exist in Tatarstan or in Alabuga regions, then the investigation should be very simple. These factories are known. We can send people there to go and investigate and come back with results. So why it is taking this long, I can't understand. It's not that these individuals disappeared into thin air. This is not the case. We have been told by these allegations that they are in Tatarstan, where they work in factories producing drones. These factories are not a million of them in Tatarstan. So we should be able to establish beyond reasonable doubt whether they are indeed South Africans caught in these appalling conditions in Russia. Then something will have to happen.
Martin, the concerns that you've just raised also suggest to me that African governments, including ours, are not necessarily taking this threat seriously enough.
I don't think they do. And I think this is something that we really need to investigate, because human trafficking has been condemned worldwide. You know, there is a treaty that countries have to enforce. And therefore, if there are allegations that human beings are being recruited into this kind of human trafficking schemes, then the investigation should be immediate. It shouldn't be something that we say we'll think about it, or we are doing it while we are not doing it. So because each day for a trafficked person is a hell. So why do we wait? You know, if you can do it immediately, send people to Russia, let them investigate and come back with result. Let's establish this as a fact and then move on with solutions. Because this is something we have to find immediate solutions, not procrastinate or not use investigation as a pretext. So for me, I think that it is a story that is very disturbing. We know the conditions in which trafficked individuals live. Each single day is hell. Mm. And therefore, we should not condemn even a minute of someone in that condition.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Martin Yiwi from the Institute for Security Studies. And that's also where we're going to leave it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.